Part 3. The Harlot. Chapter 9. Sumna. And the non-man king cried words that sting. Now to me you must confess, for death above you hovers. And the emissary answered ever wary, we are the race of flesh, we are the race of lovers. Ballad of the Inkoroi, ancient Kunaiori folk song. Early winter, 4110, year of the tusk, Sumna. Will you come next week? Esmanet asked Samatas, watching him pull his white silk tunic over his head, then down across his stomach and his still shining phallus. She sat naked in her bed, sheets bundled about her knees. Samatas paused, absently smoothing away wrinkles. He looked at her with pity. I fear this is my last visit, Esme. Esmanet nodded. You've found someone else, someone younger. I'm sorry, Esme. No, don't be sorry. Whores know better than to pout like wives. Samatas smiled but did not reply. Esmanet watched him retrieve his gown and his lavish gold and white vestments. There was something touching and reverent in the way he dressed. He even paused to kiss the golden tusks embroidered across each of his flowing sleeves. She would miss Samatas, miss his willowy silver hair and his fatherly face. She would even miss the gentle way he coupled. I'm becoming an old whore, she thought. One more reason for Akka to abandon me. Inrau was dead, and Akamian had left Sumna a broken man. After all these days, she still caught her breath at the memory of his departure. She'd begged him to take her with him. In the end, she'd even wept and fallen to her knees. Please, Akka, I need you. But this was a lie, she knew, and the bewildered resentment in his eyes meant he knew as well. She was a prostitute, and prostitutes hardened themselves to men, all men, out of necessity. No. As much as she feared losing Akamian, what she feared more was the prospect of returning to her old life, to the endless succession of hunger, anguished glares, and spilt seed. She wanted the schools, the great factions. She wanted Akamian, yes, but she wanted his life more. And this was the irony that held her breathless. For even in the midst of enjoying that new life through Akamian, she'd been unable to relinquish the old. You say you love me, Akamian had cried, and yet you still take custom. Tell me why, Esme, why? Because I knew you would leave me. All of you leave me, all the ones I love. Esme, Samatas was saying. Esme, please don't cry, my sweet. I'll return next week, I promise. She shook her head and wiped the tears from her eyes, said nothing. Weeping for a man, I'm stronger than this. Samatas sat beside her to bind his sandals. He looked pensive, even scared. Men such as Samatas, she knew, came to whores to escape uncomfortable passions as much as to glut them. Have you heard of a young priest named Inrau? She asked, hoping to at once set him at ease and carry on a pathetic remnant of her life with Akamian. Yes, I have, in fact, Samatas replied, his profile both puzzled and relieved. He's the one they say committed suicide. The same thing the other said. News of Inrau's death had caused a great scandal in the Hergerna. Suicide? You're certain of this? What if it's true? What will you do then, Akka? I'm certain that's what they say. He turned and looked at her somberly, running a finger down her cheek. Then he stood and hooked his blue cloak, the one he used to conceal his vestments, on his arm. Leave the door open, would you? Esmanet asked. He nodded. Well met, Esme. Well met. In the gathering shadows of evening, Esmanet stretched naked across the sheets and drowsed for a short time, her thoughts wheeling through regret after regret. Inral's death, Akamian's flight, and as always her daughter. When her eyes fluttered open, a figure darkened her door, someone waiting. Who are you? She asked wearily. She cleared her throat. Without a word, the man walked to the side of her bed. He was tall, even statuesque, wearing a coal-black coat over a silvered brigandine and a black tunic of crushed damask. A new customer, she thought, looking into his face with the innocence of the recently awakened. A beautiful one. 12 talents, she said, leaning up from the covers. Or a half-silver if you— He slapped her, hard. Esmanette's head snapped back into the side. She fell face first from her bed. The man cackled.
You're not a 12-talent whore. Decidedly not.
Her ears ringing, Esmanette scrambled on all fours and threw her back against the wall. The man sat on the end of her crude bed and began pulling off his leather gloves, finger by finger.
As a matter of etiquette, one should never begin a relationship with lies, whore. It sets an unfortunate precedent.
We have a relationship? She asked breathlessly. The entire left side of her face was numb.
Through a mutual acquaintance, yes.
His eyes lingered on her breasts for a moment before flickering between her thighs. Esmanette allowed her knees to part a bit more, as though an accident of exhaustion.
And who would that be?
She asked, heart hammering in her chest. The man gazed below her navel with the shamelessness of a slave owner.
A certain mandate, schoolman.
He drew his eyes up as though from a reverie. Named Drusus Akamian.
Akka, you knew this would happen. I know him, she said cautiously, resisting the urge to once again ask the man who he was. Don't ask questions. Ignorance is life.
Instead, she said,
What do you want to know?
She let her knees drift farther apart.
Be the whore.
Everything,
the man replied with a heavy-lidded smirk.
I want to know everything and everyone he has known.
It'll cost,
she said, trying to steady her voice.
Both will cost. You must sell him.
Why am I not surprised? Business. It makes everything so straightforward, does it not?
He hummed under his breath as he rooted through his purse.
Here, 11 copper talents. 6 to betray your body and 5 to betray the schoolman.
A savage grin.
A fair estimation of their relative worth, don't you think?
A half silver, at least, she said. For each. Barter. Be the whore.
Such conceit,
he replied, nevertheless dipping 2 pale fingers back into his purse.
How about one of these?
She looked at the shining gold with frank hunger.
It'll do, she said, her mouth dry.
The man grinned.
I imagined as much.
The coin disappeared and he began undressing, watching her with feral honesty as she hastened to light candles against the evening gloom. When the time came, there was something animal in his proximity, a smell or heat that spoke directly to her body. He cupped her left breast in a heavy, calloused hand, and any illusion she had had of using his lust as a weapon evaporated. His presence was overwhelming. As he lowered her to the bed, she feared she might swoon.
Be compliant.
He knelt before her and effortlessly pulled her raised hips and spread legs across his thighs, and she found herself aching for the moment she had feared. Then he was inside.
She cried out, What's he doing to me? What's he doing?
He began moving. His mastery of her body was inhuman. Soon one gasping moment slurred into another. When he caressed her, her skin was like water, alive with shivers that rippled across her, through her. She began writhing, grinding against him with desperation, moaning through clenched teeth, drunk with nightmarish ecstasy. Through her pained eyes, he seemed her burning center, blurring into her, flooding her with rapture after rapture, thrust after thrust. Time and again he would bring her to the ringing brink of climax, only to pause and ask questions, endless questions.
And what precisely did Inrao say about Maythanette?
Don't stop, please.
What did he say?
Tell the truth.
She remembered trying to pull his face down to her own, gasping,
Kiss me, kiss me.
She remembered his thick chest pressing against her breasts and shuddering, crumbling beneath him as though made of sand. She remembered lying still and sweaty with him, panting for air, feeling the thick throb of his heart through his member, his slightest movement like lightning between her thighs, an agonizing bliss that made her weep and groan with wild abandon. And she remembered answering his questions with the urgency of pounding hips. Anything. I would give you anything. When she climaxed for the final time, she felt as though she'd been pitched from a precipice, and she heard her own husky shrieks as though from afar, shrill against the thunder of his dragon roar. Then he withdrew, and she felt ransacked, her limbs trembling, her skin numb and cold with sweat. Two of the candles were gutted, but the room was illuminated in gray light. How long? He was standing above her, his godlike frame shining in the glow of the remaining candle.
Morning comes, he said.
The golden coin fluttered in his hand, bewitching her with its glitter. He held it above her and let it slip between his fingers. It plopped onto the sticky pools across her belly. She glanced down and gasped in horror. His seed was black.
Shh, he said, gathering his finery. Say a word of this to no one. Do you understand, whore?
I understand, she managed, tears now streaming. What have I done?
She stared at the coin, and the Emperor's profile across it, remote and golden against downy pubic hair and slopes of bare skin, skin threaded and smeared by glistening pitch. Bile flooded the back of her throat. The room became brighter. He's opening the shutters. But when she looked up, he was gone. She heard the arid slap of wings receding into the dawn. Cool morning air rushed through the room, rinsing away the stench of inhuman rutting. But he smelled of myrrh. Esmanette rolled over and vomited across the floor. Some time passed before she managed to wash, dress, and leave her room. When she stumbled into the street, she knew she could never return. She weathered the pungent crush of others. The custom district was adjacent to the ever-packed Ecosium Market, feeling curiously alive to the sights and sounds of her city. Coppersmiths hammering, the cry of a one-eyed man proclaiming the curative power of his sulfur products, barking dogs, the insistent begging of a man without legs, another man calling out the names of his meats, the harsh shouts of mule drivers beating their teams until they screamed, unending sounds, and a welter of smells, dry summer stone, incense, the tug of roasting meat, feces, and smoke, everywhere the smell of smoke. A brisk morning vigor animated the market, and she passed through the crowds like a weary shadow. To its pith, her body ached, and she found walking painful. She clutched the gold coin tightly, periodically exchanging hands to wipe her palms of sweat. She stared numbly at things and people, at a cracked amphora bleeding oil across a vendor's mat, at young Galioth slave girls negotiating the masses with downcast eyes and woven baskets of grain perched upon their heads, at a haggard dog, alert and peering through thickets of scissoring legs, at the hazy profile of Junraiuma rising in the distance. She stared and she thought, Sumna. She loved her city, but she had to escape. Akamian had told her that this might happen, that if Inrau had in fact been murdered, then men might come to her looking for him. If that happens, Esme, then whatever you do, don't ask questions. You don't want to know anything about them, understand? Ignorance is life. Be compliant. Be the whore all the way down. Barter as a whore barters, and above all, you must sell me, Esme. You must tell them everything you know, and tell them the truth, for they likely know much of it already. Do these things, and you'll survive.
But why?
Because spies prize a weak and mercantile soul above all other things, Esme. They'll spare you on the chance you might prove valuable. Hide your strength, and you will survive.
But what about you, Akka? What if they learn something they can use to injure you?
I'm a schoolman, Esme, he had replied. A mandate schoolman. At last, through a screen of passing people, she saw a little girl standing barefoot in dusty sunlight. She would do. With large brown eyes, the girl watched Esmonette approach, too wary to return her smile. She clutched a stick to the breast of her threadbare shift. I survived, Akka. And I did not survive. Esmonette stooped before the child and astounded her with the gold talent.
Here, she said, pressing it into small palms. So like my daughter.
Alone and on muleback, Akamian descended into the valley of Sudaka. He had taken this route south from Sumna to Momim on a whim, or so he had thought, hoping only to avoid the heavily cultivated lands nearer the coast. Sudaka had not been peopled for a very long time. It was home only to shepherds, their flocks of sheep, and ruins. The day was clear and surprisingly warm. Nansur was not a dry country, but its character was such that it always reminded Akamian of one. Its people were densely clustered around the rivers and the coasts, leaving large expanses of land that were inhospitable only because of their vulnerability to the Skilvendi. Sudaka was such a place. In the days of Kyrenius, Akamian had read, it had been one of the great provinces, the birthplace of generals and of ruling dynasties. Now there were only sheep and half-buried stone. Whatever country Akamian found himself in, it seemed he would search out places like these, places that slumbered, that dreamed of ancient times. This was a habit shared by a great many of the Mandate, a deep obsession with blasted monuments of wood or stone. So deep they would often find themselves walking through ruined temples or wandering into the library of a learned host without recalling why. It had made them the chroniclers of the three seas. For them to wander among half walls and fallen pillars, or through the words of an ancient treatise, was in a way to travel in peace with their other memories, to be one man instead of two. The most famous landmark of Sudaka was the ruined fortress temple of Batathent. It required some time negotiating hillsides and crossing scrubland before Akamian could ride up into its shadow. The immense, truncated walls spilled into gravel. Obviously, the site had been raided over the years for its granite and bright limestone. All that remained of the temple within were rows of massive columns, far too imposing, Akamian supposed, to be pulled down and dragged to the coast. Batathent had been one of the few strongholds to survive the collapse of Kyrenius during the first apocalypse, a sanctuary for those fleeing the hunting parties of Skilvendi and Srunk. A protective hand cupped about the frail light of civilization. Akamian wandered across the site, awed by the conjunction of old stone and his own learning. He returned to his mule only when the growing dark made him worry of finding his way. That night, he laid out his mat and slept beneath the pillars, finding sad comfort in the way the sun's heat lingered in the winter-cold stone. In his sleep, he dreamed of that day when every child was stillborn, that day when the consort, beaten back to the black ramparts of Golgotharoth by the non-men and the ancient Norserai, brought emptiness, absolute and terrible, into the world. Mog-Pharao, the no-god. In his sleep, Akamian watched glory after glory flicker out through Seswatha's anguished eyes, and he awoke as he always awoke, a witness to the end of the world. He washed his hair and beard in a nearby stream, oiled them, and then returned to his humble camp. He mourned, he realized, not only for Inrao, but for the loss of his old confidence. Numerous inquiries had led him through the labyrinthine offices of the Thousand Temples. Nowhere. His discussions with various shrial apparati often loomed large in his thoughts, and in those memories the priests seemed even taller and wicker thin. Many of the men had been disconcertingly sharp as well as stubbornly committed to the official explanation of Inrao's death. Suicide. His own final foolishness, Akamian knew, had been offering them gold for truth. What had he been thinking? There had been more gold in the bowls from which they sipped Anpoy than he could possibly muster. He was a beggar before the wealth of the Thousand Temples, before the power of Mathanet. Since learning of Inrau's death, Akamian had moved as though in a fog, possessed of that same inner shrinking he'd felt as a child when his father had bidden him to find the old rope he used for whippings.
"Find the rope." The voice would grate, and the ceremony would begin, lips trembling, hands shaking as they clasped the cruel hemp.
If Inrau had in fact committed suicide, then Akamian would be his murderer.
"Find the rope, Akka. Find it now."
He was relieved when the mandate instructed him to travel to Momum and join the Holy War. With the loss of Inrau, Nocera and other members of the Quorum had abandoned their obscure hopes of penetrating the Thousand Temples. Now they wanted him to watch the Scarlet Spires again. As much as the irony of this stung him, he had not argued. The time had come to move on. Sumna merely confirmed a conclusion he could not bear. Even Esmanet began to irritate him, mocking eyes and cheap cosmetics, the endless wait while she pleasured other men. As easily as it stirred his flesh, her tongue left his thoughts cold with uncertain spit. And yet he ached at the thought of her, the taste of her skin bitter with perfume. Sorcerers were not accustomed to women. Their mysteries were of a lesser kind, to be held in contempt by men of learning. But the mystery of this one woman, this Sumni harlot, stirred fear rather than disdain within him, fear and longing. But why? After Inrau's death, distraction was what he had needed most of all, and she had stubbornly refused to be that distraction. Quite the opposite. She pried him for the nuances of his day, debating, more with herself than with him, the meanings of each meaningless thing he learned. Her conspiracies were as impertinent as they were absurd. One night he told her as much, hoping only to silence her for a short time. She had paused, but when she spoke, it was with a weariness that far surpassed his own, the tone of one injured to honesty by the pettiness of another.
"This is only a game I play, Akamian. There is truth inside a game."
He'd lain in the darkness, consumed by inner turmoil, feeling that if he could unravel his hurts the way she could, he would crumble, collapse into dust.
"This isn't a game. Inrau is dead, dead."
Why couldn't she be what he needed her to be? Why couldn't she stop lying with other men? Didn't he have gold enough to keep her?
"Not you too, Drusus Akamian,"
she had once cried when he'd offered her money. "I'll not play whore with you." Words that had at once elated and devastated him. One time, when he'd returned to the tenement and hadn't found her sitting in her window, he had dared come up to her door, moved by some shameful curiosity.
"What's she like with the others? Is she the same as she's with me?"
He could hear her gasp beneath some grunting body, hear her bed creak to the rhythm of thrusting groins, and it seemed his heart stopped, clammy skin and ringing ears. He'd placed numb fingertips against the door. There, on the other side, there she was, his Esme, her legs wrapped around another man, her breasts shining with his sweat. He remembered flinching when she climaxed and thinking, "That cry is mine, mine." But he owned nothing of her. Perhaps for the first time he had understood that. And yet he thought, "Inrau is dead, Esme. You're all I have left." He heard the man crawl off her. Esme moaned.
"Ah, Calastris, you're dreadfully gifted for an old soldier. What would I do without that thick cock of yours, hmm?"
A masculine voice replied. "I'm sure you find plenty to feed your cunny, dear."
"Morsels only. You're my banquet."
"Tell me, Esme, who's that man who was here the last time I came? Another morsel?"
Akamian placed a wet cheek against the door, cold, breathless anguish. She laughed.
"Here when you came? By the gods, I hope not."
Akamian could almost hear the man smile and shake his head.
"Silly whore, he said. I'm serious. The look he gave me as he passed through the door, I half expected he'd ambush me on the way back to the barracks.
I'll speak to him about that. He gets jealous.
Jealous of a whore?
Callistus, that purse of yours is so full. Are you sure you don't want to spend more?
I'm afraid I've spent everything otherwise. But perhaps if you rattle my purse, a little something will fall out.
A moment of breathless silence, the faint sound of slapping. Esme whispered something barely audible, but Akamian was sure he heard.
Don't worry about your purse, Callistus. Just do that to me again.
He had fled into the street then, her empty window oppressing him from above, his thoughts buzzing with images of sorcerous murder, of Esme writhing in rapture beneath a soldier's chest. Do that to me again. He felt polluted, as though witnessing something obscene had made him obscene.
She's just playing the whore,
he had tried to remind himself, just like I play the spy. The only difference was that she was far better at it. Coy humor, venal honesty, naked appetite, all those things that deadened a man's shame at spilling seed for coin. She was gifted. I couple with them in every way, she had once admitted. I'm growing old, Akka, and there's nothing as pathetic as an old, starving whore. There had been real dread in her voice. Akamian had lain with many whores in many cities through the years, so why was Esmanette so different? He'd first come to her because of her beautiful boyish thighs and seal-smooth skin. He'd returned because she was so good, because she joked and lusted the way she had with Callistus, whoever he was. But at some point, he'd come to know the woman apart from her spread legs. What was it he'd learned? With whom had he fallen in love? Esmanette, the whore of Sumna. Often in his soul's eye, she was inexplicably thin and wild, buffeted by rain and winds, obscured by the swaying of forest branches. This woman who had once lifted her hand to the sun, holding it so that for him its light lay cupped in her palm, and telling him that truth was air, was sky, and could only be claimed, never touched by the limbs and fingers of a man. He couldn't tell her how profoundly her musings affected him, that they thrashed like living things in the wells of his soul and gathered stones about them. Sparrows erupted from an old oak in the nearby ravine, startling him. Regret, he thought, remembering an old Sharadi proverb, makes a leper of the heart. With a sorcerous word, he ignited his fire and prepared water for his morning tea. While waiting for the water to boil, he studied his surroundings, the nearby pillars of Batathent soaring into the morning sky, the lonely trees dark above rambling scrub and dead grasses. He listened to the muffled hiss and pop of his small fire. When he reached out to retrieve the boiling water, he noticed that his hands were shaking as though palsied. Was it because of the cold? What's happened to me? Circumstances, he told himself. He had been overwhelmed by circumstances. With sudden resolution, he set the water aside and began rooting through his meager baggage. He withdrew his ink, his quill, and a single sheet of parchment. Sitting cross-legged on his mat, he wet his quill. In the center of the left margin, he scratched, Mathanet. Without a doubt, the heart of the mystery, the Shreya who could see the few, Inrau's murderer, perhaps. To the right of this, he wrote, Holy War, Mathanet's hammer and Akamian's next destination. Below this, near the bottom of the sheet, he wrote, Shima, the object of Mathanet's holy war. Could it be as simple as this? Free the city of the latter prophet from the yoke of the Fainim? The aims declared by cunning men were rarely their true aims. He drew a line from Shima to the right and wrote, The Kisharim, hapless victims of Mathanet's holy war, or were they complicit somehow? He scratched another line from this toward holy war in the center, stopping short to write, The Scarlet Spires. At least the school's motive was clear, the destruction of the Kisharim, But as Esmonet had pointed out, how did Maythanet know of its secret war against the Kisharim? He pondered his handwriting for a moment, watching the ink flatten as it dried. For good measure, he added, the Emperor, adjacent to Holy War. In Sumna, the air was rife with rumors of the Emperor's bid to compromise the Holy War, to transform it into an instrument of imperial reconquest. Although Akamian cared little whether the Ikuri dynasty succeeded or failed, it would doubtless be an important variable in the algebra of these events. And then, alone in the top right corner, he scratched, the Consult. A name like a pinch of salt and pure water. It meant so many things. The apocalypse, the hilarity and contempt with which the great factions regarded the mandate. Where were they? Did they even have a place on this page? He studied the map for a moment, testing his tea through rolling steam. It felt warm in his stomach, braced him against the morning chill. He was missing something, he realized, forgetting. His hand trembled as he wrote, Inrau, below Maythanet. Did he kill you, dear boy? Or did I? Akamian shook away these thoughts. He paid Inrau no respect by grieving for him, and even less by wallowing in self-pity. He avenged nothing. If any redress were to be found, it lay somewhere here on this page. I'm not his father. I must be what I am. A spy. Akamian often made such maps, not because he worried he might forget something, but because he worried he might overlook something. Visualizing the connections he found always suggested further possible connections. Moreover, this simple exercise had often proved a valuable guide for his inquiries in the past. The crucial difference this time, however, was that instead of naming individuals and their connections to some petty agenda, this map named great factions and their connections to a holy war. The scale of this mystery, the stakes, far exceeded anything he had encountered before, aside from his dreams. His breath caught. A prelude to the second apocalypse? Could it be? Akamian's eyes returned to the consult, isolated in its corner, realizing his map had already yielded its first dividend. If the consult still plied the three C's, then they had to be connected somehow. There was no way they could remain aloof in such epic times. Where, then, would they hide? Inexorably, his eyes were drawn back to Maythanet. Akamian took another sip of his tea. Who are you, my friend? How can I discover who you are? Perhaps he should return to Sumna. Perhaps he could mend things with Esmonet, see if she'd absolve a fool of his frail pride. At the very least, he could make sure she... Akamian hastily set down his beaten cup, clutched his quill, and scribbled, Proyas, between Maythanet and Holy War. Why hadn't he thought of this sooner? After encountering Proyas on the steps beneath the Shrya, Akamian had learned the prince had become one of Maythanet's few confidants. This didn't surprise him. In the years following Akamian's tutelage, Proyas had become obstinate with piety. Unlike Inrau, who'd committed himself to the Thousand Temples so that he might better serve, Proyas had embraced the Tusk and the Latter Prophet so that he might better judge, or so Akamian thought. The memory of Proyas's last letter, the one that had thrown even their terse correspondence on the pyre, still stung. Do you know what pains me most when I look upon you, old teacher? Not the fact that you're a blasphemer, but the thought I once loved a blasphemer. How does one work his way back from such harsh words? But he had to, Akamian knew, and for reasons that were at once the best and the worst. He had to bridge the gulf between them. Not because he loved Proyas still, remarkable men often compelled such love, but because he needed some path to Maythanet. He needed answers, both to quiet his heart and perhaps to save the world. How Proyas would laugh if he told him that. No wonder the three C's thought the mandate mad. Akamian stood and poured the remainder of his tea upon the hissing fire. He looked at his map of connections one last time and considered the broad blank spaces across the parchment, idly wondering how they might be filled. He broke camp, packed his mule, and continued his lonely journey. Sadaka passed without demarcation. More hills, more stony earth. Esmanette walked through the gloom with the others, her heart thundering. She could feel the teetering immensity of the gate of pelts above her, as though it were a hammer fate had held poised for 1,000 years in anticipation of her escape. She glanced at the surrounding faces, but saw only weariness and boredom. For them, passage from the city seemed uneventful. These people, she imagined, escaped Sumna every day. For an absurd moment, she found herself fearing for her fear. If escaping Sumna meant nothing, did that mean the whole world was a prison? Then suddenly, she found herself blinking tears in the sunlight. She paused, glancing at the tan towers hulking above. Then she looked around, breathing deeply, ignoring the curses of those behind her. Soldiers lounged on either side of the gate's dark maw, eyeing those who entered the city but asking no questions. People on foot, on wains, and on horseback bustled about her. To either side of the road, a thin colonnade of mongers hawked their wares, hoping to profit from vagrant hungers. Then she saw what before had been only a hazy band on the horizon, surfacing here and there from the crowded circuit of Sumna's walls. The countryside, winter pale and piling endlessly away into the distance. And she saw the sun, late afternoon sun, spread across the land as though it were water. A teamster cracked his whip next to her ear, and she scrambled to the side. A wain groaned by her, pulled by flabby oxen. Its driver flashed her a toothless grin. She glanced at the greening tattoo across the back of her left hand, the mark of her tribe, the sign of Gira, though she was no priestess. The Shrial Apparati insisted all harlots be tattooed with parodies of the sacred tattoos borne by the temple prostitutes. No one knew why. To better fool themselves into thinking the gods were fooled, Esmanette supposed. It seemed a different thing here, without walls, without the threat of Shrial law. She considered calling after the teamster, but as he trundled away, her eyes were drawn to the road, which struck a perfect line across the broken landscape, like mortar between chapped bricks. Sweet Gira, what am I doing? The open road. A Kamian had once told her it was like a string tied about his neck, choking him if he did not follow. She almost wished it felt that way now. She could understand being dragged to some destination. Instead, it felt like a long fall, and a sheer one at that. Simply staring down it made her feel dizzy. Such a fool. It's just a road. She had rehearsed her plan 1,000 times. Why fear now? She was not a wife. Her purse she carried between her legs. She would, as the soldiers said, sell peaches on the way to Momim. Men might stand midway between women and the gods, but they hungered like beasts. The road would be kind. Eventually, she would find the Holy War, and in the Holy War, she would find a Kamian. She would clutch his cheek and kiss him, at long last, a fellow traveler. Then she would tell him what had happened, of the danger. Deep breath. She tasted dust and cold. She began walking, her limbs so light they might have danced. It would be dark soon.